This is Critical Edge. We're here to learn how to think, not what to think. We're here today in the Geographical Institute for the Environment at the University of Oxford with Professor Danny Dorling. Danny, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So for our listeners who don't know you, could you describe yourself and your work in 20 words or less? Tough challenge.
I am an academic, a geographer. I work mainly on social inequality.
I think that was just under 20 words there. Perfect. A question we like to ask all our guests, and can be quite elucidating, is when was the last time you changed your mind in a significant way or an insignificant way?
Okay. They're the only times I'm actually happy with thinking. It's hard to remember, because what happens very quickly after you change your mind is that you tell yourself that you always thought this. So I have bizarre examples. My favorite example is when a colleague and I thought we'd made a mistake when we were drawing a map of stepchildren, and we found that the lowest rate was in Hull and the highest rate was in the Cotswolds.
Okay.
And we just assumed we got the data all the way around. And in fact, it turned out people were very unlikely to get married in Hull, so you don't get stepchildren. And the Cotswolds are full of reconstituted families that look like a picture postcard family, mum and dad and four kids. In fact, two of the kids are his, two are hers. They both had divorces. And I'd never. So that's changing your mind from having a perception of something, that stepchildren would be associated with poverty and divorce, to actually finding it associated with affluence. Try to think of other
anything really significant, maybe in the last 20 years.
The last 20 years. Finding that the majority of the vote for Brexit was in the south of England. You know, I looked at the data, I'd assumed it'd be in the north, because that's what's been reported. It's only interesting when you change your mind. I should collect finding that most people who voted for Brexit did so because they're worrying about their grandchildren. You know, they weren't bigots and so on. They just really wanted their grandchildren to have what they had, which was the ability to start a family in their 20s, have a safe job, afford a house easily.
Yeah.
So, and whereas I'd assume that there was far more racism about it.
Well, in terms of Brexit, because I remember I listened to a podcast you were on. You mentioned how part of the reason people voted for Brexit was, you know, harking back to when they had it good. So they thought that maybe Brexit would help bring the country back to some better state.
You needed something had to happen. I mean, and of course, people asking people to vote leave were telling them everything's going to be great. But it was. The people I talk to, I mean, this is public talks, which tend to be older people come to, but they were shocked by what was happening to their grandchildren and over their life chances, and they wanted something different. And of course, these people are very old, so they're not going to live for very long. So it really wasn't a selfish thing about them specifically. There'll be other examples. Most of the things that that the life expectancy gap in Oxford is one of the smallest in the countries.
Really?
Now, people who talk about inequality in Oxford always mention it's 10 years, but in fact, it's very hard to find a city of Oxford size or large where it's not 20. So the question is, why is it only 10? And it's partly because it's so hard to get into the poor areas and to stay in there. So you have a healthy migrant effect. Possibly, we used to joke, it's possibly too much claret drunk in the richer areas of Oxford and too much free alcohol. So you only really learn when you change your mind. And it gets really, really monotonous, drawing the same maps, the same patterns all the time.
I feel like it can be quite uncomfortable as well to change, to have one's own mind change up to one's own beliefs, especially if they're really internalized, to have those challenged. In the last maybe 5 years, I've found myself moving socially and politically more to the left. But there have been moments where, you know, some of my core beliefs have been challenged by others, by, you know, doing the podcast with Ollie, with guests, friends, family, and that can feel quite internally quite uncomfortable as well. I don't know if you kind of share that sentiment or if you feel like it's quite natural.
I think it's quite natural. I think the problem, I'm 57, you know, but by the time you're 57, it takes a lot to shake your views. Mm. My views are probably largely, I think, half formed before I was 18. Upbringing and so on. I think I haven't shaken half of those, or half of those are ones I still like, but you could take me, you could make me be adopted, you could put me in a very different household, send me to a very different school, and I suspect I'd have a very different set of opinions. There's nothing innate in my genes that makes me believe the things I believe.
Well, what are your views on the state of inequalities? This is something that obviously you've written loads about, you know, and you still do.
Okay.
Could you help elucidate that a little bit for our viewers, for us?
Well, for your viewers, the important thing, the most important inequality that affects people's life chances is income, how much money they've got. It's much more important than differences between the sexes, more important than racism, more important than even inequality that affects disability, which is very bad. But income is the one that determines how long you live, your chances of education, and how you're treated. We have the highest income inequality in Europe, in the UK. However, I'm always interested in what's happened most recently. I saw a graph today from the High Pay Institute showing that top CEOs, their pay has dropped slightly in relation to the poorest quartile of their employees in the most recent year compared to the year before. It was dropping 2018 to 2019. It dropped in the start of the pandemic, basically because government said to the major firms, we're going to pay for furlough, but you mustn't take pay rises. Right? So the boss's pay went down, then it went up, it's gone down again. So I'm watching all the time, partly because I'm optimistic that we're on, potentially on the turn. Mm. But it's very, very high. We're at the level of the 1930s in terms of inequalities of income and the differences between us. We don't notice much of the implication of this, just as people in the 30s thought that life was normal. In the 30s in Oxford, there was a wall built in Cutteslowe, I think in 1934. There were some protests against it. That wall was to stop the children from a council estate being able to walk through the private estate.
Well,
and there are equivalent walls in this city now. They're largely invisible. There are wine bars and clubs that nobody local goes in, and it's not just Christchurch in them, but it's, you know, the segregation in, yeah, the city like Oxford, in some ways is bad, but it's normal. You know, it is your childhood and your life is normal. But things alter dramatically. I mean, if you go back to the 20s and 30s, the most common job for women was to work in service. It was normal if you were in a top 10% to have servants. That wasn't seen as weird. Whereas, you know, now if you are lucky enough to be invited to parties, I have, and somebody opens the door and they're wearing white gloves, and you realize it's not some strange party going on. It actually, they are the butler. You know, that is, yeah, weird now. But we have people cycling around this city delivering pizzas to people too lazy to go and get their pizza. You know, we have a whole set of servants for us, and those servants tend to be of a different ethnicity. They tend to be poorer. And it could well be that in future people say, can you believe that students had their food delivered to them because they are rich, yeah, enough to be able to pay for this?
I mean, the other example is, I guess, the scout system at colleges,
yeah,
where for our listeners who don't really know, basically, sort of 100 years ago or so, I'm not sure exactly when the change happened, but there were scouts who were basically something like personal servants. They would sort of do everything for you, clean your room and so on. And they would be dressed up kind of in a suit. So really like quite a servant feel. I don't know, sometimes they would cook and so on, organize your personal affairs. Now that's changed, but we still have scouts. They still often clean students' rooms.
Yeah.
They're just sort of in less official uniform, I suppose, something more like a polo.
They're still in the uniform. I mean, the most famous example of a scout is Sebastian Scouting Brighthead Revisited.
Exactly. That's the example, yeah.
And the idea is you turn up with your scout. He's a man. He's your man. He should literally your gentleman. Well, we don't call him a gentleman, but he will look after you and things you don't have to even think about. But students to this university used to come with their own servant, and then it slowly switches to the cleaners, who have never been called cleaners, still called scouts, being increasingly women. And you can ask, why on earth can't students clean their own room? The cleaning of rooms is fascinating. There is one state school here where the sixth formers clean the school. It's very hard to get cleaners now in Oxford. Mm-hmm. And there's one college, St. Catherine's, where the students do a lot of the serving, but they still wear bow ties when they do it, which is just egalitarian. However, for undergraduates, we are nowhere near Brideshead time. And you might ask, why do we still have scouts? It's partly because it's quite useful to have somebody who goes into students' rooms every day, which certainly I can't do. But it's true. If you're actually worried about the welfare of students, cleaning of students is really interesting. In other universities, they will normally be sent somebody in every week at least, maybe to clean, but basically to check that the cockroaches aren't going to come. Because if you don't clean the kitchen, and there's lots of you, you will get cockroaches. And if you get cockroaches, they'll spread to the other flats.
Yeah, yeah.
No, yeah.
So is that like the underlying reason why they haven't changed it, do you believe? Or do you think that's kind of a side benefit?
Other countries manage to do student accommodation without this.
Yeah.
I mean, a normal European country, you would stay at home with your parents and you go to the nearest university and it's brilliant. And Scotland, that's what you do. Elite universities, a lot of students are local. In the most progressive countries for student accommodation, Finland, the state builds and controls 90% of student accommodation. You'll get an apartment, you'll get a double bed, you'll get a cooker and oven. It's palatial. The cost is almost nothing. It's owned by the state and it's yours on your own. In Norway, and if you're an overseas student, you get first options because you haven't got mum and dad, so you get the ones nearer the middle of Helsinki. In Norway, they've got a tradition of building large kind of fraternity student houses, 12 to 18. But as far as I'm aware, they're all perfectly able to clean their own.
Yeah.
And the same in Japan. And you know, my geographer, these international comparisons are absolutely fascinating. I'll give you one other one.
Sure.
We have a constant debate that says, you must have school uniforms because they're good for equality or good for discipline or whatever. Now, we have school uniforms in almost all our schools. So does Ireland.
Malta. Yeah, I'm Maltese, so aren't they?
Okay. There you go. And you'll know why Malta and Ireland have them, because they're British. Now, the majority of Europe manages to have schools without school uniforms, and there aren't riots. And school uniform, and the obvious country which definitely doesn't put children into uniform is Germany, because the Hitler Youth wore a uniform. So the really basic geographical comparisons help you sort out, is there any validity in this in particular arguments? Mm. It would be lovely if we got to a point in this city where we weren't so worried about our students' mental health or their inability to clean and get cockroaches that we didn't have to have people coming in. And nobody has to come in and, that's not good. Where I live, I'm feeling guilty about how much housework I do and aware that my partner may watch this.
Okay. So before we sort of get into fine-grained analyses like those, let's start with a really wide scope and then we can zoom in. So we had an academic, Steven Pinker, on the podcast. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Yeah.
His basic position is that it's not actually inequality, which primarily matters for welfare, but actually basically the minimal state of the standard of living, and then you can have basically a high ceiling.
Yes.
So long as we provide that minimum.
The minimum safety net, yeah.
Yes.
It's a great example of what I was saying earlier about if you could have taken me and adopted me and put me, it's not Steven Pinker's fault that he grew up where he grew up, but he grew up in a place where that's widely believed. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting that academics, say we've had great ideas and so on, but that's the basic liberal USA idea of just provide a minimum for the poor and everything else will be okay.
Yeah. So basically my question is, you think that actually welfare is maybe not directly correlated, but very, very strongly correlated with the inequality for economic reasons as well. based on the general proportion of wealth that poor people have as well. So maybe you could provide some kind of counter argument to Stephen Pinker's view on an economic level first.
Well, the country he's based in, where he says this is all you need to do, mm-hmm. has one of the worst infant mortality rates in the rich world, the lowest life expectancy, worst problem with drugs, highest number of people in prison, more than all the other countries of the rich world put together, eviction rates, however many millions of people sleeping rough in cars. Oh, before you start worrying about guns, which are, you know, the main problem with guns in the US is people shooting themselves. I mean, we worry about gun crime, but actually most of the deaths are because if you fill a country with guns. And the amazing thing about the US is that even the richest 1% don't live longer than the richest 1% here, and our richest 1% don't live as long as in mainland Europe, and far more equitable, and just overwhelming. Then you could go, oh, it must be something else. It must be trust, you know, and it's because people trust themselves more that they agree to more similar incomes. But over time, the evidence that inequality matters So the worry is, it's become as accepted as something like eugenics was in the 1920s. By explaining that, I mean, it might not be right, right? This is the point about being a social scientist. You always assume you might be wrong. Eugenics, the idea that some people were bred to be clever and others not, and we had to stop the poor breeding, otherwise we're all going to become stupid. Mm-hmm. In the 1920s, that was believed by people on the left and the right. The founders of the Labour Party believed it. It was a theory that was incredibly popular around the world, and it was wrong.
Yeah.
So there is a chance that the theory that inequality is really, really bad because the correlations are so high might be wrong, and it might be a proxy for something else that really matters, or it might actually be that some people are quite able and most people aren't. We really need the able people to be in charge, and they're only going to be in charge if you pay them enough. I'm trying my best to, you can't find an unequal country in the world. Well, there is one unequal country in the world in which people are doing relatively well and feel they're doing relatively well, and that's China. China is as unequal as the United States, but the thing about China is almost everybody knows that their grandparents were really poor and that they standard living was rose. And people in China are not yet worrying that much about the fact they've got multimillionaires amongst them, because they're able to do things that they couldn't imagine. And they sometimes go to the United States on holiday and come back and go, thank God I don't live in the USA. And
I might feel like that sometimes. I think when I went to, I had a friend who went to California recently, and he was telling me, about basically the extent of the opioid problem, the heroin problem in California.
I went to San Francisco in 1995, so that's 30 years ago. And I remember the shock of stepping out over homeless body after homeless body, people were alive, but I've never seen, because we didn't have that problem.
We don't have any homeless people in Malta, not one.
Yeah.
Not one.
Yeah, not one.
It's amazing.
No.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
But you haven't got Tree Viver.
That's true.
Well, you asked. Not for two, but never better. The biggest shock, I went to the plenary session of Association of American Geographers' big conference. The plenary session was on poverty, and there were only 6 people there. And I suddenly thought, this is why things are so bad in America. You know, they're just not interested in... Mm-hmm. And because it got to the point then of just seeing these people were losers. They were there because they hadn't tried. This is just how the world works. At least they're all clustered in that area. Mm-hmm. I've worked hard. I deserve my mansion up on the hills above. Mm. And very strange society.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, what is your basic safety net? Are you going to put them into hostels? Whereas the kind of country that, the opposite country, maybe I'll try and make this last time I mention it, but Finland, I've written a book on Finland.
Yeah.
They have a problem of tens and tens of thousands of homeless people often drinking. And that was really problematic because they would die if they were outdoors in the winter, but they heat, but they heat the toilets and the subway. So sleeping down there in public toilets. And the Finns decided to end homelessness and did. because they saw the other Finns as people.
Yeah.
And there's been lots of research showing that people in the US have stopped seeing homeless people as people when you scan their brains. And similar places like India, where the rich of India can look down and don't. Yeah. Because if you do see other people as people and they're suffering, it's very hard not to do anything about it.
That's the thing with homelessness. And again, I just want to clarify, you know, there may be a small percentage of homeless people in Malta, but it really is so low, that percentage, when you come to Oxford and you see the people on the streets.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned this as well in something that you wrote, that when international students come to Oxford, you know, unless they're American, they're surprised.
Yeah. We're all shocked. Well, I got a shock because I lived for 10 years in Sheffield, and there was a point in the north where I remember Newcastle was hardly any homeless people, partly because people are so friendly that if somebody tries to sit down on the street, people stop and ask them if they can help them. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of housing. But there was relatively little homelessness in Sheffield. And we came down, and one of my children was about 12, 13, and there was somebody begging, and he just stopped his bike to go and give him his pocket money. And I remember being utterly shocked and realizing, oh, he's never seen this before. And if, not saying my child's particularly nice, it's just if you're a child and the first time you see somebody with a cardboard sign, whereas, you know, we're completely used to it, you know to walk by, not to look, maybe make eye contact if you're nice and nod, you know, and some nice people do give and you're told, oh, it's all going to be. It's very easy, very, very easy to get acclimatized into behaving in ways you would otherwise think was terrible. And there's lots of examples in history about terrible things done by very large numbers of people. And all it takes is not seeing other people as human.
For sure. Yeah. So we started kind of discussing the economic impact. Yeah. And as the discussion's gone on, I guess we've moved on really to something more like sociological, psychological analysis. You're a human geographer. So I guess to ask a clarifying question for our listeners, what's unique about the geographical way of looking at these issues and assessing them, and how do you pull like different disciplines together?
It's not having a discipline. So geography is such a tiny discipline. It's not like psychology and sociology and economics, which are much more global disciplines with thousands of departments. We have, I think, maybe just under 100 departments in the UK. We have by far the greatest concentration of geography departments. The average in the USA, only about 1 in 10 universities has a geography department. The big departments around the rest of the world are at its colonies. I don't know of one in Malta.
I wouldn't go to university. I wouldn't know. But
no.
Probably not.
But certainly, you know, a very good department in Singapore, a very good department in Hong Kong, several departments in Australia, in New Zealand. You can see the pattern. This department, it was in a different building, was set up in 1899. With a letter in the Times asking for money to help start a geography degree to train young men to run the colonies, right? There's a reason why. So geography is a British, the modern geography, was geography obviously in the past from Mercator and Chinese geography, but modern geography is largely a British creation, which teaches you how to run an empire, hills, mountains, cities, villages, peoples, everything, 3 years, you know, you can run Nigeria. Once you lose an empire, you need to do something else with discipline. It could have gone the way of anthropology, which is very small. In a way, luckily for geography, things like climate change came along, which kind of fell in our lap. Bad for the planet, good for the subject. And in human geography, it's inequality and differences between people, but also a very, very large openness to other disciplines because we don't have a discipline. My colleagues along the corridor on the human side of the subject can do whatever they like, really. And that may sound bad, but it does allow different kinds of thinking.
Mm. Yeah. So you've really focused in on equality specifically.
Yeah.
I'm sure, like you said, you know, about with upbringing and everything, part of that will be just experience and so on. But you also think it's basically one of, if not the most pressing issues or crises in the world.
Yes.
And that gives it that primacy, basically.
Well, that shocked me. So I did the book, The Next Crisis, which is based on the Ipsos Mori polls. And to find that, I hadn't realized that inequality and poverty had actually come up in the polls to be your number one. And then the cost of living crisis knocked it to two, but they're similar. And I had worried about my own bias. Well, I'll definitely have biases. You'll notice that they. I was shocked to find that there is a general and growing acceptance. Depends how you ask the questions, but of, well, seeing the rich as a problem, you know, that was in the 1980s, men of your age on football stadiums would have wads of cash and would shout out loads of money, particularly if it was a northern team playing. And the idea was you should just make lots of money. You should work in banking if you can. You should get a nice suit, a flash car. Making money was a good thing. The Wolf of Wall Street, all that kind of. A cultural change to, we don't, hardly anybody goes, people who make lots of money are really, they, you still get it, you know, the wealth creators, but there's a smirk, you know, that's kind of gone. Mr. Dyson and his vacuum cleaners, you know, okay, he makes an interesting vacuum cleaner at a factory that at one point was in Wiltshire, but where is it now? But you know, it's just a vacuum cleaner.
It's really just a vacuum cleaner.
You know, and there were very similar vacuum cleaners available that worked possibly just as well, but you're not paying for the patent. Yeah. And he's made himself quite a lot of wealth, but the idea that it's trickled. I mean, you know, Wiltshire's nice, but you know, it's quite hard to find the trickle down around that part of Wiltshire.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The trickle down is, guess around like Devon and the second houses are people who made money in London, but they're making it through financial transactions, which is basically taking a slice out of something else.
Yeah.
And then you end up with a trickle down of money in posh parts of Devon. Mm-hmm. But that isn't.
I mean, the rich people, this is something that actually we wanted to discuss in relation to rich people creating wealth for a country. Or let's say the top 1%, is that how much do they contribute to a country's economy? Because BMW in Cowley, for example, obviously on its own is made up of thousands of employees. So is it those employees or is it maybe the smaller, richer individuals who control the BMW, for example?
Who control the company from Germany.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's doing it? Well, it's the robots. I mean, you go, and it's wonderful and it's amazing. Yeah. So
right.
This factory and the factories around it, this is Oxford's biggest export earner. It's actually economically by far the most important thing in the city. So I've got the universities. A Mini comes off the line every, I think, 1 minute, 2 seconds when the line's working at full rate, which it isn't since the Trump embargo on cars. But, you know, a minute compared to a DFIEL student every 3.5 years, which if you're talking economic equivalence, that's an overseas student.
With journals, which maybe not as many people are reading as you might want.
And I was sort of fairly serious about the robots. There were about 40,000 men in that factory and ones around it. Now you could say that original car factory was all about the brilliance of Lord Nuffield, the paedophile. It's just the menu. Just Google Lord Nuffield paedophile and we don't talk about that very much, but it does help before we start saying Lord Nuffield is superhuman. Now, Lord Nuffield was certainly an ambitious man and he had a bike shop he set up and he had drive. He had political ambitions. He funded the British Union of Fascists. At times, he did sort of various things with his money that were good. We tend not to talk about the things he did that were bad. But those cars built in Oxford in his factories were largely built by men in terrible situations and some women doing that and not a slightly strange man who behaved in slightly strange ways. But it's just useful for... now, certainly who brought those factories down and when it became British Leyland down and so on, well, they were the workers. There were years in which there were 600 strikes in a year. You know, several strikes a day on some days. So if you're asking who did it, the who brought it to an end was the workers and who was doing it was the workers. The bosses, when you look at their lives, are not necessarily that brilliant. BMW come in. They come in, I think, for the name, the word Oxford, they'll say, and the Mini.
Sure.
But again, I don't think it is that different. I very early on, he contacted me, the head of the factory. This is about 10 years ago. Getting old, so I don't worry about saying. He wanted to know why our engineers in this university weren't interested in going to the factory. And of course, we teach a different kind of engineering and not a actual how to make a car engineering.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Interesting difference between German engineering. But he was really interested in, they wanted to integrate more with the city. I think there's only about 3,000 people working there now, mainly looking after the robots. There was one manual line and six robot lines when I went. But my hippie left-wing answer to who's actually making it work is it's a collective of people, and it works at the moment. It's worked for a number of years because it's the idea that's more prevalent in Germany, that you have people who are in the workforce on the board and the unions on the board and the states involved, and you all work together. And it isn't about single brilliant individuals. Mm. You know, electric cars are not about Elon Musk. Yeah, it's not that, and it's not. But if you're trying to defend a very high salary or wealth, then the kind of myth of superhuman creative beings is one you want to promote. However, can you defend, you know, in Lord Duffield's case, taking enough money from the workers of Oxford to build a college in Oxford, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. Slightly reducing the scope then from the wide scope. I wanted to kind of talk specifically about, we've touched on it, the cultural elements of inequality and how it's viewed and what impact that has. So maybe just kind of run through the history of how inequality has developed, maybe in the UK. Of course, there's rampant inequality before the Great War and then the Second World War. A lot of that was aristocracy, just old money, basically.
Yeah.
And then you had a lot of wealth tax in the Great War and then in the Second World War. I think you said in your book that there was something like a 99% wealth tax by the end of the Second World War.
I think it's 99% income tax, but a very high wealth tax. I mean, yeah.
Income tax and wealth tax, yeah.
There was a marginal rate of income tax that at one point got to 98%. I think relative of mine had to pay it. The First World War was only about the first last few weeks. And went on for years and had to be paid for. And the only people who could pay were the people with the money, and that was the people with the great houses. It was quite interesting how governments did it, but inheritance tax was used to raise money. Quite a lot of wealth. There's a lovely book called Born to Rule that was published last year by Sam Friedman and Aaron Reeves, which has incredible statistics about all this in it. But one is about how a large chunk, possibly, if I remember right, 40% of British wealth suddenly disappeared at some point in the late 50s and 60s as the families with money realised if you don't get the wealth out of the country, it's going to be taxed. But it was certainly government action that helped the greater equality to happen. And the fear of things like the Russian Revolution, you know, the revolution actually happening, stopped it being theoretical that this could happen, and it's real. And, you know, it's worth being slightly nicer to people if there's a chance they might get guns and shoot you. And I don't think we should underplay the importance of that having occurred. But most importantly, to my mind, and I could easily be wrong, it was a changing moral attitude amongst the very rich. It was people like Tawney, who was here, Beveridge, who was married to his sister. John Maynard Keynes, who was a Bloomsbury set, very rich. These were very rich people. And they began to see things differently to their parents. So they had...
Beveridge was... he basically founded the welfare state, right? Was he the one who did the report in 45?
The report was published in 42. It was written by him and civil servants, but he was the master of UNIF at the time. So imagine this, right? You know how busy a master of a college is. Mm-hmm. Imagine the old days where you're running a college, you're running UNIV, but you also write a very detailed, very complicated report. But he did it in the war. Beveridge went from being a eugenicist when he was young, having, in some ways, quite sort of dodgy views, through to somebody who changed. It was around him. The upper classes were changing. He went to an elite public school. Mm. I forget which one it was. it was like a hippie sea change in the top 1%. And I still don't quite know why it happened, and I am obviously picking out the individuals who, but it must have been so strange for them. I mean, most of their friends would have thought they were weird. Their parents certainly wouldn't have been happy with what they were suggesting.
Yeah.
But that happened. But remember, there was the first Great Depression in 1929. There was mass unemployment of older men, you know, worse in a way than the 80s, which was younger people. They are still a memory of a slaughter of a war on an industrial scale, the First World War. There was a clear build-up to us doing it again. The students in this university in 1938, Dennis Healy brought a copy of Guernica, the portrait from the bombing, to the senior common room in Balliol in 1938. A group of other students, much to the annoyance of the university authorities, staged a protest. This is one thing. Mm-hmm. And they had a play in which a concentration camp was built in Christchurch Meadow in 1938 as a warning of what they thought was coming. And one of them was Iris Murdoch. And what I love about this story is Dennis Healy became Chancellor of the Exchequer later. Iris Murdoch, brilliant novelist. Nobody remembers the university administrators or the proctors. for 1938. And these were the young. These are students, 18, 19, 20 in Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Keynes and so on, and Beveridge. But Beveridge was a master of the college. Something was going on.
Yeah.
The empire was getting smaller. All pre-war, and then in the one bang. It much bigger than the 1960s kind of hippie thinking and Tariq Ali. But the key thing I'm trying to say, which annoys lots of people on the left, is it was the very well-off change in their minds. Really masses. Other people striking, agitating, yes. But you don't get large change without people from the best of families changing their views.
Is that bad news for our listeners who might be kind of rioting up from let's say looking up rather saying we need to wait for the ultra rich to do something about it? Let's say
it's not bad news, but you can't ignore the ultra rich or the pretty. You can't ignore the 1%. You can't go, we will do this our own. You know, as a working class vanguard, we will seize the levers of power and so on. I mean, that happens extremely rarely. And even when you do get a revolution, it ends up being quite a well-off middle-class person ends up being at the top of it anyway. Mm. But it means you do need to think about the attitudes in your private schools of England. You do need to think about the attitudes in a university like Oxford, which is, well, now less posh than Durham and Bristol and Exeter. Mm. But it really matters what better off people think and believe. You can't just go, well, let's forget about, say, 5%. If we get 95% of people with us, we can win. You can't, because that 5% of writing all the newspaper stories, absolutely filling the BBC, it's, they're not aware that the 5%, this group of people, which I'm bang in the middle of, if not slightly above the middle of the top 5%.
Sure.
This group of people largely think they're normal. Many of them think they're not well off because they can't afford a house in Fulham, say. But that group I has always been vital, is vital in other countries. In many European countries, that top 5% mixed much more with the rest of the population. And they did mix. They famously mixed as men in the trenches in the First World War. Tawney spent a day in a shell hole injured. They mix in the second. It's when you don't mix that you can begin to have thoughts about other people that are quite nasty, that they are subservient, stupid. It's very hard to believe that people are stupid if you grow up with them. Mm.
So do you think, kind of to track then from the end of the Second World War and to take your point about kind of the separation between people, there was this sort of post-war consensus, it was called, right up until about 78, basically, until Thatcher came in, which is pretty pro-welfare state. Equality was on the rise and so on. Living standards were going up. And then that changed. That took a change in the other direction.
Yes.
How much of that is due to cultural elements like the ones you mentioned of awareness of the other and things like that? And how much of that is direct political action and so on? And how might those link?
You can trace it back to the Monday Club and Mayfair in the 1960s, but And it certainly started amongst the top of the elite, amongst men who really didn't like what was happening. Often a bit like Brexit, where so often the people at the top of wanting Brexit, their fathers were colonial officers, and where they come from. So that was the beginning of push. But Callaghan did a speech here in Oxford in 1976, which was slightly moving it. It was certainly a shock. It was thought that Thatcher was only going to survive one term, but she doesn't. I think the move to equality was so fast and so shocking, to go from service being the most common job for women to there being no servants, you know, just 30 or 40 years is a revolution. Mm. And a whole set of people who had grown up thinking that they were going to rule the world, be Viceroy of India, now couldn't even run a biscuit factory, and they were not happy with this. And that if they did manage to run a biscuit factory, they'd be paying 98% tax. Yeah. You can see how they're annoyed. They changed the Conservative Party. They got rid of the old guard. They got rid of the Etonians and the aristocracy who used to run it. And they put a woman, you know, the daughter of a grocer. Now, he actually owned two shops, so he was in the 1% to begin with. And then she married Dennis. She came here, and then she was in the 0.1%. And we sold her, the British people, as daughter of a grocer.
Yeah.
It happened. It carried on during the 80s. And the huge thing, and it kind of, it wiggles around the time of John Major, and then John Smith dies. By 1993, 94, we have another post-war consensus. The Labour policy had moved to the Tory one. The Labour Party promised before the 1997 election to stick to Conservative spending plans for the first 2 years. And it did. 97, 98, 98, 99. Vote Labour, voted Blair, you got Tory spending plans. We've had a consensus again.
Yeah.
Since then, with a brief period of Corbyn being leader, but of Labour, which was breaking that consensus, but was seen as madness. And you know you've got a consensus when the alternative, which are Corbyn's policies, which were very similar to Merkel's in Germany, but not as left-wing as Angela Merkel, when that's presented as economic madness, you know you've got a consensus. So we've had two consensuses, the post-war consensus and then the Thatcherite consensus that we're still in.
Right? Yeah, I mean, well, it's interesting because I suppose kind of end of 90s as well, it carried on with like this, I guess, being linked to the Cold War, this idea of the end of history from Francis Fukuyama and stuff like that. There's sort of an idea that this is where we're at. Slavoj Žižek says something like we're in a post-political age. Yeah. All these political parties really don't differ in policy that much.
Yeah.
Specifically on economic policy.
They tend never to. So that they political parties within the country, most of them tend to be very close together. If you're in the country, you don't think they are. You think this is huge and really important. But, you know, it doesn't actually matter who wins the election in Sweden or in Finland or in Spain. Essentially, those countries will stay in the pecking order in terms of progressive taxation or not. Slight differences. You know, the Conservatives built more council houses than Labour in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And the current Labour government is deporting more people on planes than the Conservatives managed to do. You know,
yeah, but it's just packaged differently, right?
Yeah, you occasionally get these turns, and you can draw graphs and see them. And the question is, what made the turn happen then? And then they all travel together for some time.
Well, the question I was going to lead to was, do you think we're kind of seeing a turn right now? You mentioned, for example, it's becoming more and more normal to not be a fan of inequality, let's say, to not be a big fan of the super rich.
Yeah.
What do you think is causing that, and how significant do you think that is right now?
I think there's a sense that we failed. So hardly any politician stands up now and says that Britain's done really well, you know, or we carry on along this route. And there was quite a lot of that. In the past, there was George Osborne in 2015 said if we stuck with his economic plan, we'd be the richest country per capita by year 2030. Johnson in his Raise the Nation speech, very similar. Keir Starmer said it, you know, it's kind of, if you carry on with our plan, we'd be the best off. And it's just sounding hollow and stale. People are slowly becoming aware that the average living standards are lower in the UK than in Europe before Brexit. So there's a sense of, I think, general failure. It gets reduced to Olympics for a few weeks when we tend to win a few medals because we're very good at sports that other people don't play that much, being a bit mean. And we put a lot of money into it with national pride. US, China and us spend a lot of money on getting medals. My worry is I don't know in what direction it'll go. In it is quite conceivable to see that Elon Musk's people might get bored with playing with Trump and say, what can we do with $50 million in the UK? Let's play a game, just a game. You know, can we take an election? There's ways in which they can do that. They can bin the money in, which is not actually illegal if they channel it through. So that's one worry. That's other. Yeah, Sterling could tank this summer. So many things could go wrong.
I feel like there's a lot of discussion around, this is maybe a slight tangent, but solutions being things like higher taxes on the rich people, right? Mm. Something Ollie and I were discussing a little bit before this interview was, how beneficial is it to say we need to increase taxes on the rich people, maybe especially in Britain? Some of the downsides we were discussing was this risk of flight.
Yeah.
Once you start taxing rich people more, they will leave the country, maybe go to Dubai, go to places like
Malta. It's really boring. Malta's all right, but you know, how many years would you like to spend in Malta before you're old? Or?
Point is, it's taking me back to the initial question about BMW, which is, whether these individuals are really contributing to the economy. Is it even, let's say, a bad thing if they leave the country? Is that going to negatively affect the economy? And will they leave, I suppose?
There's been a lot of reports about how unlikely quite a lot are to leave because London's so sticky. But also about how little damage might be done by people who don't have a high income. They've got high wealth and they're non-dom at the moment. And to be non-dom, you have to have most of your financial interests not in the UK. So they're not already contributing. We've got a nice natural experiment in that in part of Britain, in Scotland, we are taxing people more. So somebody like me would be facing a 53%, slightly higher tax rate on part of my salary. And that extra tax is being used to pay for the Scottish Child Credit, which means that no child in Scotland need go hungry or cold. And like in England, Scotland has the lowest rate of child poverty in Britain. Scotland has the only areas in which child poverty is falling, right? So we're actually the best evidence is something really being done somewhere and seeing what happens. Mm-hmm. And as yet, the university professors and hospital consultants are not fleeing Edinburgh and Glasgow and St Andrews and going, I can't stand Scotland.
Fair enough.
So we've actually got an example, and it's not me saying, look at Finland and Norway. It's saying it's happening. You also tend to get quite nice, very rich people in more equal countries. Again, this might annoy some people, but when somebody with a lot of money, my favourite example is always ABBA, the pop group, and why they decide to stay in Sweden despite having to pay high taxes. The rich in more equal countries tend to get involved in politics less, tend to manipulate less, tend to actually, they promote the idea of you pay more taxes because you're joining in the society. And ABBA's lovely. I wish we could do a proper study of this. They also tend to live longer and be happier on average. So the American equivalents to ABBA are mostly dead. Michael Jackson, you know, he don't want to go to Neverland Ranch. You want to go to Stockholm.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess part of the issue then, to look forward to solutions potentially, you mentioned some examples where higher taxation works. But a lot of the problem is about collective action. So for our listeners, that's basically organizing a set of individuals who have their own motives such that they can act together effectively. Now, a lot of the problem is, well, all these individuals have different beliefs and it's very difficult to get everybody to align in that way. For example, a large portion of the population, we saw how well Reform did recently, believe that kind of immigration is the central problem. How can we look at getting around those collective action problems? Is it just a matter of collective consciousness raising or...
Oh, no, it's learning from them. I suspect the very top of Reform are a very small number of people. are the ones I know. It's a tiny number. I suspect the people who decided where they want those riots to happen, which happened last summer, and seeded the fee to say, you know, this is the Holiday Inn we need to burn down. And, you know, we almost have pogroms in Britain. When you look at the map, it's almost all in the north, apart from one small case in Bristol, and almost all in areas of the highest index of deprivation. So much so that it's like somebody went, where is the index of deprivation? Let's just rank it in an Excel spreadsheet. And, you know, so I see those kind of things as orchestrated by a small number of very dangerous people. And they stop and they start.
But those people who are maybe on those riots, do they probably, there's a lot of them, right? And they maybe share in that sentiment.
Somebody has to book the coach to take them there.
Mm.
Somebody has to start off the tweets that, yeah, it was so unlike the 2011 London riots, which were much more organic when a shooting of a man, but then completely out of control. But I think we should be worried about, yeah, they were turned off and turned on. This is when Starmer had just become prime minister.
Could you maybe just expand on that a little bit for our listeners? Because I know for me personally, for example, I didn't know about the level of organization that went into a lot of this for the recent riots.
So the people you saw on the, you know, at the front fighting the police were generally men like me, but more bald. Was it then? I've less hair. Might have been skinheads when they were young, as fat as me, if not fatter. Didn't really know what they're doing. There's a famous one who throws the brick and it goes back and hits him. And you know, the very famous crotch. But they don't. A lot of egging on. The question is, who got them there? Who and the pattern? If it just been one event, you couldn't make any assumptions. Just one, you don't know. But the pattern of and the starting and the stopping of it, you know. You don't organically, in communities angered by years of immigration, suddenly start and stop. Like, you know, this is my allegation, just my belief. I haven't seen it. And I do wish there'd been much more investigation into. People have been prosecuted for certain tweets, but I worried. And these were a really serious set of riots. I mean, this is attempted murder, you know, that's trying to set light to a hostel in which people are living, you know, let alone arson. On the other hand, well, to give you the good, there's a group called 20's Plenty, which argued to get 20 miles an hour in. Most of Oxford's 20. All of Wales is 20. Most villages around here were 20. I met 20's Plenty first when I was in Sheffield. It's two people. Just two. It's much better to have two people than one. But two people can help make a city go 20 miles an hour. Rod King and Anna organised it nationally. That's Rod and Anna. That's two people. Possibly the most successful social movement in Britain in actually getting what it wants. 30 miles an hour signs becoming 20 mile an hour signs. Huge effect on mortality rate.
Really? Big difference.
Huge difference. So you'd probably be okay if you're hit at 30 or 28. But a smaller child or an older person, they tend to live if hit at 20 because the physics of moving a ton of metal at that speed. And already we get more and more and more data because the 20s are coming. But nobody campaigns for their own street to go back up to 30. And all that happens, of course, and you had to be an idiot. You had to be an idiot not to see this. But at 20 miles an hour, you just take a little bit longer to get up to the traffic lights, which are red. It doesn't change journey times hardly at all. It just makes things more pleasant. But it's a shock. It feels like a massive imposition. Your freedom's been taken away. You can see it's perfectly safe to go at 30. Why are they making you go at 20? And of course, exactly the same argument could have been made for why can't we go at 40 or why can't we go at 50 for Oxford? You know, I'm looking really carefully as I drive through Broad Street and turn. When I was young, there were cars on Cornmarket.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so when I went for a series of, you know, from one point we got rid of the cars in Cornmarket because it was full, and then we had buses and we had bus walls. Thatcher bought in competition. So there had to be lots of different bus companies. And what happened in Cornmarket is they all just ended up getting stuck and jammed. We never.
All right.
And now this street, sorry, I'm talking about Oxford, the street's pedestrianised.
Yeah.
But you know, the next question is, what are we going to do when there are so many tourists that they stop moving?
I mean. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to move to your book now quickly, The Next Crisis.
Yeah.
One of the things that really caught me in the book was basically your discussion about our perception of what actually is a crisis. And one of the key concepts you talk about for that is elite projection.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about elite projection and how that might feed into some of the things we've already talked about.
It's when you're told something is really important, because it's important to people at the top, but it may well not be. My favorite example at the moment, I could well be wrong, but I'd love if I'm right, so it's worth recording this, so is AI. People at the top of are sort of really worried about what AI might do, or they're intrigued, partly because it's new. Most of our sort of crises are the same old ones. You know, they are poverty, inequality, war, they are unemployment. But elite projection is being told this is the thing you must worry about, or immigration. So, you know, supposing I believe that actually I, Danny, do deserve to earn twice as much as I'm currently getting. Mm-hmm. And people like me deserve to get twice as much. And the person who may come in to try to clean this room, but I think they've realized we're here, well, we could pay them half as much, because cleaning the room is not useful, whereas me pontificating to you is massively socially useful. Now, I could use democracy and say to you lot, look, I'm clever than you, you know, just can you vote to make sure the university pay me twice as much? But, you know, using democracy to promote inequality doesn't tend to work. Well, I could say to you, well, look over there. There's some people on small boats and they're arriving on the shores at Dover and they're really going to be a problem for you. And you know, there's 40% more of them than there were this time last year. Those small boats, and there's other people coming, and they're all going to come and take your country, and it won't be your country anymore. But, you know, worry about them. Let me, I'll control them. I'll control our borders. And quietly at the same time, I'm going to have some more money. So, you know, elite projection is a mixture of things, but getting to people to think about something that they wouldn't otherwise think about and using your position, your power to do that.
You think like Starmer's recent policy, for example, that, you know, people who come to live in England should speak English, for example. Do you think that's, these are crucial issues in society? Is it, because to be frank, I think, you know, in England people should speak English in general, but how important really is it? That's kind of part of the question.
Well, I've heard it all my life. All right, so we've had a serious language problem for years as opposed to the rest of the world, in that we can't speak any other ones. I mean, this is dramatic, you know. In most of the world, people speak two languages. In most many interesting places, it's far more than that. The sad thing is, how on earth does this carry on being raised? There used to be far more people here who couldn't speak English, because in a lot of the world, English wasn't used. So people would come to Oxford, Pakistan. The second language of my school was Urdu.
Really?
The second most common. But all the kids, of course, could speak English. Their mums very often would only speak Urdu and not English. And they would have to go with their mum to the doctor. And the doctor would tell them that their mum had cancer when they were 12. And they would tell their mum in Urdu, you've got cancer, right? Now, the idea that we should say it's terrible that that woman hadn't learned English, right? She's not choosing not to learn English, right? It's just really difficult, just as it'd be really hard for me to learn Urdu. But the kids all learn English, happily learns English. You do eventually, it's quite hard not to. And there's an insensitivity. There are two counties in Britain where the legal language in schools isn't English. It's Welsh.
Hmm.
But we don't demand that everybody in those counties, everybody else, learns Welsh, even though these are Welsh counties where Welsh language is the official language. We could do, it'd be fuzz. Why not give them all a test in Welsh and then just take them out of their house in Gwynedd if they can't speak Welsh? You know, if you really want people to join in and learn the official language. I don't believe Starmer believes a word of this. I don't believe he does. I think he's not stupid. I'll give him credit. I think he's not stupid. And if he's not stupid, he's playing a dangerous game. I don't think he believes a word of it. I think he's blowing the dog whistle. I think he's worried about his own position when Labour did so terribly badly in the local elections, and his advisors, which are a strange small bunch of folk, his advisors are telling him, you've got to play the race card to keep your job. I could be wrong. That's my gut feeling. I think he's clever enough to know that it's a stupid argument. And I'm worried that he's a bit desperate, and he's worried if things carry on and Labour carries on losing local elections and popularity, if he carries on so incredibly low in the polls as a prime minister compared to previous prime ministers. So he's got to do
it's a difficult task already.
He is quite difficult to get below trust as soon as. He's got to do the man of the people stuff. I understand the common people. I'm like that. You know, I can wear a hard hat. Forget that I went to a posh school in Surrey. Forget, you know. I think it's a rather desperate attempt. And I think it comes from being advised by people who think this might work, who don't realise how dangerous it is to stoke up racism, who are all white and have never actually mixed much in a school with people who speak Urdu.
Mm-hmm. So the next crisis isn't immigration. The next crisis isn't race issues. The next crisis is inequality. Basically, what happens if it keeps increasing? And what should we expect for the future?
Well, in many ways, it's been decreasing. So globally, between people, incomes have been decreasing, largely because of the rise of China. In most European countries, the Gini coefficient of inequality is decreasing. A lot of the wealthy are not as wealthy as they used to be. So the ton of times used to produce lists of the 1,000 richest families and others are the 250 richest. The wealth been concentrating wealth, the billionaires. And this is fascinating. So, and it's quite difficult for them. I mean, it's partly why you begin to hear Peter Thiel and others sort of arguing, we really need to stop democracy. Because when Margaret Thatcher came to power in 1979, she was supported by 30% of generally better off people. And she kind of doubled their money in her 10 years. She made the people who supported her better off, and that's 30%. Right? That's a chunk that you can do something with. Since then, since the 1990s, it's generally only been the 1% who got better off. You know, 99% not. It gets harder and harder in a democracy. And now we've got to a point where the wealth of the billionaires, which is so different from multimillionaires, is to grow in one. Now, it's scary, but it's kind of good. It would be worse if the best off third in the world were getting richer and the poorest were getting poorer, because a third of people basically could just control everything. I'm not being sanguine about it. It's just, don't think when they tell you that inequality is rising all the time, it is in general. It's just that we tend to concentrate on the inequalities that are rising and talk about them as the problem.
Hmm.
We don't talk about the world's middle class or upper middle class shrinking down in towards the average. And that is actually the kind of thing that has to happen. But what you want is for the average to be good. And most, when I talk about most people in the top 5% don't think they're well off, they're all looking at the folk who own two or three properties and the holiday home and can afford. So soon as you get what happened before and the wealth and the incomes of the people above you comes down towards yours, there's generally less angst, anxiety, and a feeling that you're losing out because you can't do what they do. And we tend to compare ourselves to people just above us. You'll have ambitions about what you want to do in life, and your ambitions are probably based on people who are maybe a little bit older than you, doing a little bit better than you. You don't tend to concentrate on your friend who's not doing as well as you are now. You kind of think, oh, it's a bit sad, but you know, maybe they get themselves together. But you don't look at your friend doing worse than you and go, oh, aren't I doing great? Right, because that'd be a bit me. But you do look, it's normal. And then you compare themselves. In a more unequal society, you're going to feel worse about yourself. Whereas in a more equal society, it's much easier to feel happy about what you're doing. In most equal countries, if you want to do a job that's normally low paid, I always use nurse as an example. You could be a nurse. If you want to be a nurse, if you want to spend your life really helping people when they need help, but not a flash doctor, a nurse, you get a salary that means you can live a nice life and be a nurse. You can't do that in Britain. It's not an option. There's a whole load of jobs.
Teachers.
Yeah. The idea of being a teacher. Well, the teachers in this city, they share houses like students used to. So they can be a teacher for a few years, but they can't have a child. So there are only three schools in this city which have got so many teachers in their 40s and 50s. Oxford High for girls, Magdalen and Charwell, the state school. The city is absolutely full of very nice teachers in the 20s, but you do need a few older teachers. Whereas in other European countries, a teacher is rewarded enough and the house prices are lower that you can have a good life and you can aspire to be a teacher. Well, you know, we have a program ridiculously called Teach First in this country, where the idea is they will put you into a school, a rough school, which wouldn't be rough if you just gone to normal school, and you'll teach for a couple of years before you do your proper job in finance, hence Teach First. And it's just madness, you know. You should aspire to be a teacher because you're going to teach first, middle and last, and what you want to do is teach. And it's a huge privilege to be a teacher. And that was the case in the past in Britain, at the beginning of that era of greater equality. And it is the case in many other countries that teachers are really, really respected.
You know, it's interesting because my grandma was a teacher, and she speaks about it so highly nowadays. But, you know, I think nowadays, if I, you know, you go around and you ask someone, what do you want to be when you grow up or what's your aspiration? They say a teacher. Many kind of would almost say, oh, only a teacher. So to speak, that I feel like that's the general sentiment, which is unfortunate.
It is
one of those important jobs there are.
Yeah, Harold Wilson, one of his children became a train driver, and the other one became a teacher, I think, or maybe a university teacher. And there's a famous quote about Tony Blair being asked what he wanted for his children and described what happened to him, and Tony Blair going, no, that's failure. I don't want that. And it's part of the problem of wide inequality. When I was growing up in this city, a doctor would get twice a car worker, which in pay a few years ago might be about £60,000 a year, but a car worker would be on 30. A teacher would be on about 45. You know, difference, but you would still go on holiday camping. Mm. You might get a caravan. You didn't have these completely parallel lives that we now have. If a teacher's having good holidays, they're married to somebody rich. So one reason why schools work quite well in London is, one is immigration, but another is that teachers very often have a partner paid more than them.
Yeah.
Because there are high-paid jobs in London, and their teachers often female, and it's a man in finance. Our problem in Oxford is we don't have a finance sector, so the teacher's the highest earner of a couple, and you know, you're competing with students for, you don't want to be competing with students for housing, particularly as we have an influx of overseas students doing postgraduate degrees where there's quite a lot of money. But it's all problems. This city is full of problems of inequality.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. I think that's all we have time for, but we've really enjoyed the discussion. So before we close up, if you have any last thoughts for our audience, anything you want to leave us with?
No, I just hope you edit it really well so you take out the more bumbling bits. Thank you so much. That was lovely.
We really enjoyed it. So
thanks for watching.
This has been Critical Edge. Thank you for watching. Please like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.